This is Matt Wells at UN News. Well, 6 billion people, that's the bulk of the developing world, look set to suffer from the economic impact of the new coronavirus pandemic, the UN Trade and Development Organization, UNCTAD, says. Even before the disease hits the most vulnerable countries on the planet, those that rely on exporting their raw materials, the UN body says that there were clear signs late last year that 2020 was going to be a very tough year. In an interview with UN News' Daniel Johnson by Skype, UNCTAD economist Richard Kozel-Wright outlines how a radical plan worth a staggering $2.5 trillion could help avoid some of the worst financial consequences of COVID-19.
Positive messages are not easy in this environment, but I think the language has changed as people move from thinking in terms of very aspirational kind of language to getting more concrete about how you deal with a very, very real world problem. And that's true at the international level, as well as the domestic level. And that's a positive, okay? What is slightly discouraging for us is that while you've seen these very large numbers for the core of the G20 countries, and we're really talking about the core, the US, UK, EU, Japan, China, there just hasn't been the attention paid to the countries that will probably be facing the serious damage from this crisis, which is the bulk of the developing world.
So that's 6 billion people you suggest in your latest report from UNCTAD, the UN Trade and Development Organization. So you suggest a $2.5 trillion package for them exclusively. What does that involve, please?
Well, we suggest a kind of four-step package. The first one is that developing countries are going to be very short of liquidity. Developing countries can't spend abroad with the money that they have. Countries don't accept it. So they need to get access to foreign currency. And there's a huge shortage of that. And so a large chunk of the $2.5 trillion will be international liquidity. And we propose using the IMF's special drawing rights as a way of generating missing liquidity that developing countries can access, up to something in the order of $1 trillion.
So that's the International Monetary Fund, and they developed this so-called special drawing rights, which is a means to create money where needed from the members of the IMF. So we're talking, what, the US, the European Union, Japan, and the UK, among others.
Well, I mean, what special drawing rights does is allows countries to tap into the major reserve currencies. You can't go out and spend SDRs in your shops. You can't, or you can't give it to someone that you're buying your automobiles or your aeroplanes from. So it's a transaction within the international banking system that allows countries access to the major reserve currencies, the dollar, the yen, the euro, the renminbi, etc. So that's the mechanism that we want to see augmented to make sure that developing countries have access to the liquidity in the face of the kind of financial hit that they're going to take from the dynamic that you just described.
And when have these SDRs, these special drawing rights, been used before?
Well, they've been around for, they were originally introduced into the system in the late 1960s, early 1970s. Not on a particularly large scale, but they were augmented significantly after the global financial crisis in 2009. Something in the order, if I recall rightly, of $180 billion worth of SDRs, we're suggesting that we'll have to have a much greater number than that this time around, in large part because SDRs, the allocation of SDRs, depends significantly on the quota system inside the IMF, and the quota system is very heavily biased towards advanced economies. So if we were just going on the usual pattern of allocation with SDRs, developing countries wouldn't actually get very much because their quotas are very small within the IMF. So either you'd have to forgo the traditional allocation system or you'd have to increase the size of SDRs by a very, very significant amount. Probably some combination at the end of those two things, a reallocation of existing and the addition of new SDRs.
And you're also looking at offering the developing countries or distressed economies, as you say, a debt jubilee, and that would amount to also $1 trillion. And then you're looking for a Marshall Plan for a health recovery, which will be funded by some missing ODA, missing official development assistance, which has been long promised but not delivered. And what does that equate to, please?
Obviously, one of the real concerns that we have in UNCTAD, it's a long-standing concern, is with the size of on the scale of indebtedness of many developing countries, and not just the least developed, but middle-income and higher-income developing countries. And they are facing a huge debt wall over the course of the next couple of years in the order of $2 to $3 trillion. And so we have suggested in the report that a two-step process, actually. I mean, we would need to see, to begin with, simply a debt moratorium to put an end to immediately to any kind of servicing of existing debts, followed by a serious effort at restructuring and cancellation of debt, as you say, to the order of $1 trillion. So I think to seriously give developing countries a chance of mitigating the kind of damage that we see from this crisis, the dealing with the debt problem is of paramount urgency. In addition to that, as everybody has acknowledged, including the G20 last week, there's got to be a serious effort to strengthen resilience of developing countries when it comes to the health crisis itself. And one of the great difficulties of thinking how this crisis is going to affect developing countries is the fact that the economic crisis has hit many of these countries before the health crisis. So the health crisis is still to come in many developing countries. Now, if that crisis comes as these countries have been significantly weakened by the economic shockwaves from the crisis, then that is a very dangerous cocktail to have, a very vicious combination of an economic crisis and a health crisis. So we've got to find ways of strengthening the healthcare system and services in developing countries and building up resilience on that front very quickly.
Yes, and your final point in your four-point blueprint is to reduce capital outflows from countries. And you say in your report that there was $59 billion leaving main emerging economies in the month since the COVID-19 crisis went global. So that's from the late February to late March period. And that's more than double what left the same countries after the global financial crisis, $26.7 billion at that time. So why can't we see the same kind of recovery that we had in the 2008-09 crisis?
It's very difficult to predict recovery. And we're still trying to understand the details of the big packages that have been announced and how those will impact not only on the economies implementing them, but also on the global economy. So there's a certain amount of uncertainty there about the way in which these packages will actually impact on the global economy. So that's uncertain, and we're still looking into that. I think the difference between 2008 and 2009 is that some of the conditions that allowed developing countries to bounce back very quickly in 2009-2010, and they did, developing countries bounced back much more quickly than the advanced economies then. Some of those conditions are either weaker or have disappeared altogether. So one of the critical factors in that bounce back, of course, was the resilience and strength of China in 2009. China introduced a very large stimulus package in 2009, which had very beneficial impacts on developing countries, a lot of commodity demand, participation in value chains. We don't think that's going to be true this time. And we also see a lot more financial vulnerabilities in developing countries than was true in 2009. A lot of developing countries have built up a lot of debt since the crisis, both public sector debt and also corporate debt in emerging markets. And there's a lot of new vulnerabilities around that that make the kind of recovery we saw a decade ago less likely than today.
So if our only hope is this $5 trillion rescue package from the IMF, from the International Monetary Fund and its member partners, what's the solidarity among the international community? What's going to make them do it, basically?
Well, I think what hopefully will make them do it is that this is a genuine global crisis. Right, they can't solve either the economic or the health problem by putting their own house in order. That's just not possible in this case. And so obviously there's a humanitarian dimension to the kind of package that we're proposing, but there's also an insurance dimension. You know, these countries are potentially large markets, large sources of investment opportunities for advanced economies. Banks in these countries already have large assets accumulated in these countries. If they see those markets and assets collapse, then it's bad for them too. So there's an interest in having large parts of the South recover quickly, for their own economies. And that's true of the health crisis, because we know now these pandemics are highly contagious. And even if the advanced economies and China begin to get some control over these, if there are large-scale outbreaks in parts of the developing world, it will be very difficult for the advanced countries to kind of contain, to stop that at their borders and reigniting similar kind of problems in the future. So they have a vested interest in supporting developing countries, both from an economic and a health perspective.